This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. About the pandemic, wouldn't it be great if, as former CNBC host and current director of Trump's National Economic Council, Larry Kudlow, declared, it was all over?
Presidential leadership came swiftly and effectively with an extraordinary rescue for health and safety to successfully fight the COVID virus.
After a spring semester held mostly over Zoom, many of the nation's colleges and universities have reopened with precautions for the fall.
Today, Cal revealed plans for undergrads. University is using a hybrid model with large lectures provided remotely.
Potential guidelines for UC Berkeley students living on campus this coming fall. Only a limited number of students would be allowed to live in dorms on the campus.
The University of Arizona is helping contain the coronavirus pandemic by using a special new app that tracks students.
These precautions are a gesture toward sensible public health decision-making, but they've so far failed to protect against some predictable co-ed behavior.
UNC issued a campus-wide alert reporting new clusters. Texas A&M ordered chapter-wide quarantines for two sororities, and a fraternity house at Georgia Tech is on lockdown after at least two dozen tested positive.
At the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, over 500 cases. At the University of Missouri in Columbia, over 200. These infections not only imperil the students, they also threaten their institutions' blue-collar workers and their parents and grandparents and communities. Scott Galloway is professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and co-host of the podcast Pivot. I asked him, why the decision to open the doors?
Money. If you're a liberal arts private school or even a public school and you get, say, between $30,000 and $50,000 in tuition, let's say you get half of that up front, and you have 20,000 students, I mean, you're literally expecting, in some instances, $300, $400, $500 million to roll in a two-week period in the late summer. And then all of a sudden you wake up and you're facing potentially 10, 30, 50% reduction in that cash flow. When you see these university presidents making strident statements around welcoming students back to campus, I think that's Latin for parents, please send in your tuition checks.
And in the face of all of this, what kind of school suffers the least and what kind the most?
So let's take Princeton, Harvard, and Stanford. Princeton has the largest endowment per student. Harvard has the largest endowment just by gross tonnage, $40 billion, and I think Stanford is in the top five. So if there's three schools that should have the resources to figure this out, testing every day, protocols, reconfigure the dorms, it's these three universities. And despite these resources, what they've decided is they're going all remote. And the reason why they're going all remote is, again, because they have the most resources. And that is they're not worried about a short-term hit to their balance sheet, which indicates that the companies that aren't going remote feel more financial pressure to stay open.
You contrasted the Ivies with a publicly funded school like Cal State and suggested that those schools also have more flexibility than the ones in the middle.
That's right. There's the guys at the top that have a lot of resources and can afford to stay closed and be remote, and they have amazing brands. And by the way, the 20% of students who stay, they're not going to show up at Harvard this fall. Harvard will have no problem filling those seats with their waiting list that consists of 95% of the people who applied and didn't get in. So they're fine. They're bulletproof. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you mentioned Cal State, 500,000 students, $7,000 tuition in-state, $17,000 out-of-state, about 80% are commuters. So the value proposition there isn't a leafy college football game experience. The value proposition is some certification, some education at a really good price. That largely remains intact in a period of COVID. And as a result, they were one of the first to announce they're going all online. They have the confidence to say, look, we're going to focus totally on online learning. We're going to shut this down for this semester. And we look forward to welcoming you back, hopefully, in spring, in January or February. The ones in the middle are in a more difficult spot that has led them down this rabbit hole of what I would call incremental bad decisions.
Are there data that show enrollments have in fact fallen?
According to the surveys you read, you know, over half of kids, freshman kids, say they would prefer an all remote experience.
I wonder what the number one preference is among parents of freshmen.
We should be careful not to conflate the calculus around deciding what we're going to do with K through 12. And higher ed. When you're talking about the decision to send kids back to school with K through 12, you're talking about developmental disability, you're talking about economic strain, you're talking about a single mother who can't go to work, nutrition, you're talking about the collapse of households. A 19-year-old stuck at home that can't return to Tulane for his or her sophomore year is a nuisance, not a tragedy. And I think the media portrays it as a tragedy because it's happening to wealthy households.
You've suggested that we were kind of headed in this direction anyway with regard to higher education.
Well, just to use a pandemic as a metaphor, there's several comorbidities across higher education, and this has been the opportunistic infection that may kill a bunch of them. And that is, just demographically, population growth among college-age kids has either been flat or down in most states, so there's just fewer consumers. Two, we've been raising prices faster than inflation without any underlying increase in quality or innovation. So whenever you raise prices faster than inflation, you make yourself vulnerable, especially if the product isn't very strong. Think about technology that every year improves dramatically. Your computer, your browsers, the apps you use, dramatically different. And the price goes down every year. Education is the opposite of technology. Less for more is the way you would describe education over the last 40 years. And we've reached a tipping point. After talking to a bunch of leadership at the what I'll call the elite universities, the MITs, the Browns, the Dartmouths of the world, I'm now convinced they'll double down on their exclusivity. They no longer see themselves as public servants. They see themselves as luxury brands, and their key attribute is their scarcity. They're essentially hedge funds educating very wealthy kids and some freakishly remarkable kids from middle and lower income households such that they can wipe Vaseline over the fact that they've totally lost the script. They're not about education. They're about positioning themselves as luxury brands.
You've said that the ultimate vehicle for a luxury item is to massively and artificially constrain supply. Harvard had more people in the past, but now they celebrate the fact that each year they're able to reject more.
At NYU, our dean will stand up and say we rejected 88% of our applicants, and people see that as a good thing. I would argue it's tantamount to a housing shelter bragging that it turned away 9 in 10 people who showed up last night. I don't think it's anything to be proud of. Spring used to be a nervous but an exciting time to see where you were going to college. Now it's become the Hunger Games, where you have to call on every contact. And then if you're lucky enough to get into a school, you have to sit down and plan out how the household is going to take on that level of debt. The real value here is the certification. Mm-hmm. The $380,000 that Yale is going to cost you, that value is recognized when you get in. And that is, for the rest of your life, you'll have this branding that says you got into one of the world's most elite exclusive clubs. Just look at influence. Only a third of America has a college degree. Only 10% has a graduate degree. But look at the economy, culture, media, the most powerful cohorts in America. What is it, 90, 98% have a college degree?
You say the cruel truth of what pretends to be a meritocracy is a caste system, in that your degree largely indicates your lifetime earnings.
The angle of the cannon you're shot out of is not only whether or not you're getting a college degree, but where you're getting that college degree. And then the question is, well, who gets shot into this world of amazing prosperity? And it's generally two cohorts. The first is the children of wealthy people. If you come from the top 1%, you're 77 times more likely to get into an elite university. If you come from the other 99%, 88% of kids from households in the upper quintile go to college. In the lowest quintile, it's 8%. You just have an entirely different prospect of not only going to college, but going to a great college when you have access to what I'll call the industrialized test prep complex, where your dad might know somebody. I see it happen personally. Most of my friends are financially successful. They call me because they might think I have some pull at one of the universities I'm affiliated with. And you can just see how kind of the wheel spins. Mm-hmm. There is a second cohort, and it's what I would call freakishly remarkable 15 to 17-year-olds. And here's the thing. America needs to fall back in love with its unremarkables. I can prove that 99% of our children are not in the top 1%. To be fair, universities have done a great job reaching into lower-income communities and finding remarkable kids. But the test of a society and the role of higher ed is not finding remarkable kids and making them billionaires instead of millionaires. It's what we do with our unremarkables. And the U.S. higher ed, I would argue World War II to 2000, used to be a place with a son of a single immigrant mother who lived and died as secretary, got to go to UCLA for total tuition for $4,000, then to graduate school at Berkeley for a total tuition of $5,000, and then go on to be a productive citizen and have remarkable opportunities and have the chance to come on public radio and talk about higher education, yours truly. That's not happening any longer, and it's a national tragedy.
So what happens next?
Well, I think where we're headed is the following. I think the truly elite universities are going to double down on their exclusivity. They're going to look, smell, and feel the same. They'll use technology to enhance their offering, but it's not going to be core. I think the opportunity is for some of the great state systems, Ohio State, University of Texas is 200,000 kids. University of California is 250,000 kids. Cal State is 500,000, to embrace small and big tech. And if you take 50% of your classes online, and another dirty secret of academia is about 50% of our classes probably could be online without a huge erosion in value. But if you take 50% of the classes and put them online, you've effectively doubled the size of the campus, doubled the capacity. So good kids, not just remarkable kids, have an opportunity to get a remarkable education at a much lower price.
But they won't be credentialed if the school's not fancy.
Yeah, I think the degree from UCLA in the 80s may not have the same level of prestige as it does now, but I still think you can get a great job. I still got a job at Morgan Stanley. I still got into graduate school when UCLA was letting in 60% of its applicants. It's now 13%. I think this erosion in brand value is BS. They are not in the business of education. They're not in the business of advancing our society. They're in the business of being alternative investment hedge funds. Stanford just decided, because of quote-unquote financial pressure, to shut several sports teams down. And the question is, well, why don't you use part of your $35 billion endowment? And they said, we don't have access to our endowment because we might have capital calls from the commitments we've made to private equity funds that we're investing our endowment in.
What's a capital call?
So an organization like Stanford, who has an endowment of $35 billion and a huge team of well-compensated investment managers charged with increasing it, they make investments in private equity funds or hedge funds that will go out and buy companies, buy stocks, and they commit to, say, $1 billion. And then over the course of the next 3-5 years, that private equity fund will say, okay, we need the money, and they call it or draw it down. Mm-hmm. And then when you get a capital call, you're supposed to send in your money. Nearly every decision among university leadership, I believe, over the last 2 decades has been with one goal, and that is to reduce our accountability and increase our compensation. And the net effect of that is there has been a transfer of about $1.5 trillion in wealth from middle-income and middle-class households to universities and tenured faculty. The transfer has to stop. We need a reckoning. We need to dramatically lower costs and dramatically increase supply. We need to let technology set us on a path where we can substantially decrease the cost of delivering education over the next decade.
So when you say embrace big tech and small,
it's everything from handheld technologies from Apple to CRM from Salesforce to some of the existing tech out there, to Zoom, to Squadcast. You're going to see an explosion in tools focused on higher learning. There's going to be more money invested in ed tech over the next 24 months than there has been over the last 24 years. I think that's a social good. I think that's an investment worth making. The way I would summarize the issue here is I teach 160 kids, typically in the fall, my brand strategy course. It's $7,000. Because we're going online, they've increased the capacity. And I'm now teaching 280 kids starting in 3 weeks. It'll be all online.
And it'll still be $7,000.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, they've increased tuition 3.5%. So think of it this way. Over 12 nights of Zoom, NYU is going to charge these 280 kids approximately $2.1 million. Pfizer just came out with a drug to treat muscular atrophy that costs $2.1 million for a treatment. And I started thinking, okay, which is worse? Preying on someone at the most vulnerable point of their life and asking them to figure out a way to give you $2 million to help with their disability? Or is it preying on the hopes and dreams of middle-class households spread across 280 of those households and putting them $7,000 more in debt such that they can have access to a better life? And I think the answer is yes. Which is more morally corrupt? Yes. I think we have to take a hard look at what this means in terms of a transfer of wealth from middle-income households to universities. It's gone on too long, and the reckoning is overdue.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Scott Galloway is professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and co-host of Pivot Podcast. Coming up, math, schizophrenia, and the story of a life saved by the internet. This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.